This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we hear from three different people speaking at events next week for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Coming up, Erlene McMichael talks to April Rain, creator of the Oscars So White social media movement that helped diversify the Academy Award nominations process. Rain speaks in Grand Rapids on Monday. And later, I will talk with Miriam Kaba, founder of an organization to end youth incarceration. She speaks Monday morning at Kalamazoo College's Stetson Chapel. But first, the Reverend Jonathan Tremaine Thomas says he had planned on going to Ferguson, Missouri for a short-term assignment in 2014. But then he decided to move his family from Indianapolis, joined the pastoral team at Destiny Church in St. Louis, and continued to work on race and social justice issues. Jonathan Tremaine Thomas will speak on Sunday in Kalamazoo at the Northside Ministerial Alliance's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So when I read your blog, you said that you were moving to St. Louis to be, and I'm quoting, a sellout. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, obviously I'm an African-American man, and I am married to a white woman. So sometimes within our community, you can lose the proverbial black card when you marry outside of your race. You know, so I've been accused in some circles at times of being a sellout. But the reality is my interracial marriage has uniquely positioned me to be able to speak not only to the issues of my own community and my own experience as a black man in America, but also to understand even some of the more insensitive perspectives that maybe someone of the majority culture or another experience may have, since I'm married to a white woman who did not grow up in a black community. And so I feel like it's uniquely positioned me to be a bridge. And with that said, you know, we wanted to sell everything. When we saw the intensity of, obviously, 2014 Ferguson, which could almost single-handedly be pointed to as a catalytic moment for the protest culture that we have in America today, when just the intensity of the environment.
So obviously you're moving to the St. Louis area after the shooting death of Michael Brown, which touched off a protest in Ferguson, Missouri. As you know, we sit here and talk now at the beginning of 2018. Do you see signs that there has been some sort of improvement, that there has been progress?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we live in a culture, some people would call it a microwave culture. We want everything quickly, especially the younger kind of millennial generation, maybe those who don't necessarily have a lot of knowledge concerning how intensely painstaking and how long it takes for nations to actually mature and to be transformed, much less small cities like Ferguson. The shooting caught everyone off guard. No one was prepared for the level of unrest that came to Ferguson and came to St. Louis. And so I think there are factions of the city that said that, you know, we've been waiting for change for too long. It's taking too long. But the reality is Ferguson has shown an amazing amount of resilience. The residents there who have labored painstakingly over the last, you know, 3 years, going into the fourth year now, to make reforms. I think the mayor of Ferguson might be the most tested white man in government in America today. He's sat in front of angry mobs of people and been called every name in the book, but he's also taken a long and hard look at himself and the governmental structure there. And I think Ferguson has a long way to go, but there are many wonderful citizens and public servants and activists that are learning how to hear one another and move ahead.
There have been other incidents, though, since you moved to St. Louis. There was the acquittal of Officer Jason Stockley in a fatal shooting in 2011. You were quoted at that time during some of the protests that followed by St. Louis Public Radio saying people are losing hope. They're going, we've marched in the streets, we've had a civil rights movement, we've elected a black president, we've had a woman's suffrage movement. We've had all these rights movements, and then these things still happen. So what is there to do for people when they feel that they are doing things the right way, they're protesting peacefully, and yet they don't see as much progress as they want?
Well, I think the reality is that acquittal was yet another reminder of a history of injustice, not just in Missouri, but in our nation. This state, in particular, the city of St. Louis, was the place where the historic Dred Scott decision happened in 1857, which said that African Americans and the descendants of the African diaspora were not humans. And the U.S. Supreme Court made that landmark decision, which then set in place, it really laid the groundwork for the Jim Crow laws of the South and so many other structural things that have historically oppressed black people. So from the shooting of Mike Brown and the conversation of the value of a black life to, again, another police action situation where, at least on the surface, it seemed pretty point blank that there was an intent to murder and then the officer got off. I think the people are just so weary from the lack of perceived justice. And we know there are gray areas in some of these events that only a jury or a courtroom would have access to the documentation. But the bottom line is, from an emotional standpoint and a psychological standpoint, you have a real weariness and a real hopelessness in the American justice system, especially when you have a proven history of legislation and structures that said on the books that black people were not humans. You know, they say that only a fool does the same thing and expects different results. And I think our model for pursuing justice was what our forefathers and foremothers did in the civil rights movement, the protests, the sit-ins. And we've been doing that. I think we default to those models. But I think we need a higher level of action and engagement.
So what is there to do if not protest? I mean, have you found yet the other thing, the next tool that you would use to try and get progress and advance social justice?
Well, I think one of the valuable things of the current protest movements is protest does work in measure. It gets you to the table. When people don't want to pay attention, it gets attention. I think one of the things that I've noticed over the last few years is there's a void in leadership that possesses the temperament to articulate the concerns of some of the black communities, some of the minority communities, to articulate those concerns in a way that they can be received or heard from those who may be on the other side of the table. There's so much information, so much confusion and even frustration, I believe, on both sides of these issues, that a lot of times, you know, after you've done the battles on the streets, it becomes a battle at the conference table, when we need mediators who can help us lay down our weapons and get to a place where we can really hear one another and move forward.
You wrote an assessment of Ferguson, which at the end explains how we can look at the power of railroads, and that tells us something about our history and also perhaps about our present and how it ties into these issues. Explain that to our audience.
Absolutely. You know, the railroads, when that technology, if you will, first emerged, it was said that, you know, the railroad has made the world smaller. And all of a sudden, there was a connectedness between places that were previously worlds apart. And interestingly enough, Ferguson was a city established as a railroad stop. But the railroad is a metaphor, or in my mind, it's symbolic of two different pieces of iron. They're both strong, but they're side by side. And this side by side reality is representative of unity and being able to, if we can come side by side, there's a load or a weight that we can bear together, and it can connect us to a destination that we share.
Reverend Jonathan Tremaine Thomas is pastor at Destiny Church in St. Louis. He will speak on Sunday in Kalamazoo at the Northside Ministerial Alliance's 32nd annual Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, I talk with the woman who created the Oscar So White viral social media movement. With a single tweet in January 2015, April Rain spurred a national conversation about the lack of diversity in Academy Award nominations. The Academy has since vowed to make its voting pool more inclusive. April Rain is the MLK Day speaker on January 15th at Grand Valley State University. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you very much for having me.
What did you do for a living at that exact time that you started that hashtag campaign?
In January of 2015, I was still actively practicing as an attorney, not in the entertainment field, however. I was also working as the managing editor of Broadway Black, which is a multimedia digital platform that focuses on the highlights and successes of African Americans on and off the Broadway stage.
Can you walk us through what upset you so much?
Sure. I guess I was more disappointed. In January of 2015, I was a moviegoer, just like all of your listeners are, and I was watching the Oscar nominations on TV that morning as I was getting ready for work. And it struck me that year, and unfortunately that year is not by any means an outlier, but it struck me that year that so many of the categories, both in front of and behind the camera, the nominees were incredibly homogenous. There was not an interesting mix of people from marginalized and traditionally underrepresented communities. And so very organically, I just picked up my phone and tweeted, "Oscar So White, they asked to touch my hair." Obviously, is a very common reference to what Black women go through in society.
Oh, okay. So you were trying to make a statement.
So it was a very snarky one-off comment. I finished getting ready to work, and I didn't check Twitter again until lunchtime. And I checked in and found out that the hashtag was trending internationally, which was definitely a surprise. And there were jokes being made about the hashtag because I was being sarcastic in my one little tweet, and so that's how people took it. It wasn't until a couple of days later when we had a very much more interesting discussion about the issues of diversity and inclusion, at that time about the Oscars, but the conversation now has broadened to the entertainment industry as a whole.
I just want to revisit what initially disturbed you. It's not only that they weren't nominees of color and from marginalized communities for the sake of having them, but rather there was, in fact, a body of work that was worthy of recognition. Is that what you're saying?
Well, of course. There are always movies that should be nominated, in my personal view, that are not. Recently, what we saw with the Golden Globe Awards is that the movie Get Out was completely snubbed by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Now, this is a movie that is already being taught in school. The movie Get Out had amazing box office success, quite a bit of critical acclaim, and yet did not receive any significant awards other than a Best Actor nomination for Daniel. And so what we see throughout the years is that, yes, there are movies that should be nominated. And that's why what I talk about is not just the actors and the actresses, but the issue behind Oscar So White is much broader than that. So it's also talking about who is behind the camera telling the story. The directors, the editors, the cinematographers are just as important. But the onus finally must be on Hollywood. So because the Academy, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and other organizations can only nominate quality films that are made, the onus must be on Hollywood to greenlight and create those films that tell the stories of the experiences of traditionally underrepresented communities.
I was just looking at your tweets after the Golden Globes, and it looks like there were some things that did please you. You were talking about Oprah's speech was the speech of the night. She was a Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement winner. And I know that you were pleased that Sterling Brown of NBC's This Is Us, got a Golden Globe for Best Actor for a TV Drama. He's the first African-American male to get that honor. You were pleased with those. Were you pleased with the number of awards given to people of color and marginalized communities at the Golden Globes?
No. And that's why I mentioned Get Out specifically, because I believe that Get Out should have been nominated for Best Screenplay, Best Film, Best Director. I think that Girls Trip was another movie that was snubbed with respect to perhaps Best Actress and Tiffany Haddish, and also Best Comedy. You know, we see movies like Hangover, which won the Golden Globe in 2010 for Best Comedic Movie, and that was a raucous buddy movie about a getaway trip. Well, Girls Trip is the same thing, a raucous buddy comedy about a getaway trip. Girls Trip, again, was submitted by Will Packer Productions. It had an amazing box office. It was the movie of the summer and also had critical acclaim. It had 90% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which is basically the industry vanguard with respect to audience review. And yet it was also snubbed completely by the Hollywood Foreign Press. And so that's why, with respect to Oscar so white, I also talk about who the nominating bodies are. You know, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association keeps their membership roles very tight and close-lipped, and so we're not exactly sure who they are other than to say that they are journalists who may be from other countries. With respect to the Academy that runs the Oscars, we know a little bit more. And in fact, since Oscar So White began in January 2015, the Academy has committed to doubling the number of people of color and the number of women by 2020. So people like Melvin Van Peebles is now a member of the Academy when he wasn't 5 years ago.
And how do you feel about some of those changes? Is this enough change for you?
No, obviously not. There's so much work that needs to be done. You know, I will be holding the Academy's feet to the fire to ensure that they, in fact, make good on their commitment to double the number of people of color and women. But even when they do, the Academy will still be overwhelmingly older white male. And the issue with that is that we all need to operate outside of our own frames of reference. So when you hear people who are members of the Academy say that they didn't go see the latest Lupita Nyong'o's performance because they didn't know how to pronounce her name, or they say that they're not going to go see a film, you know, like Selma because, well, that's old history and, you know, and we don't need to revisit that anymore. But they will go see a film like Dunkirk, which is also, you know, a historical movie. It makes you wonder how people are actually submitting their votes, because very famously, the Academy does not require its members to view the films before they vote. So I've always said with Oscar So White that all of these awards, you know, Grammys, Emmys, Tonys, Oscars, and so on, should be based on a meritocracy. You know, let the best performance win. But if you're not even viewing the performance, then that says that you're using something else on which to cast your ballot, and that does not seem fair.
People do lobby quite hard for their films. Do you think that that's what's influencing the Academy voters and, like you say, not actually watching the film?
Well, I think that can be one part of it. But some of the trade journals, like Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, talk to anonymous Academy members every year. And it is astonishing, the information that they provide. You know, oh, well, I just voted for this film because my agent told me to. Or I voted right after I read something in Variety, and that's the name of the movie that stuck out in my head. Or this particular performance wasn't that exciting, but this actor has been around for a long time and has never received an Oscar, and so it's time for him to get his due. None of those have to do with the actual performance, which is what I think all awards should be based on.
We've been talking to April Rain, creator of the viral hashtag OscarsSoWhite. In commemoration of MLK Day, she delivers a free talk at 1:30 p.m. on Monday, January 15th at Grand Valley State University Fieldhouse Arena. For links and a longer version of this interview, go online to WMUK.org. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Arlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Miriam Kaba is an organizer, speaker, and author. She is also the founder of Project NEA, which is dedicated to ending youth incarceration. Miriam Kaba will deliver the annual MLK convocation Monday morning at 10:50 in Stetson Chapel on the Kalamazoo College campus. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How big a problem is youth incarceration if we look across the country at minors who are actually behind bars?
Every year we have about 60,000 young people incarcerated across the country on any given day. And that number has steadily come down over the last 25 years. The 1990s were pretty much a peak time for youth incarceration. That wouldn't surprise anybody who remembers the rhetoric around super predators and the coming demonization of all these black and brown kids who were crack-addicted babies who were going to, maraud our streets and cause all sorts of harm. So that was that period of that kind of moral panic. So a lot of people were much more likely to criminalize young people. So that is an issue. I think the bigger issue for young people is criminalization as opposed to incarceration, and that means arrest. There are millions of arrests of young people every year, and whatever contact a young person has with the law is often criminogenic. So it basically leads them down paths of further criminalization. So what we want to do is address youth criminalization more broadly, and as part of that, certainly address youth incarceration. I think it's important to put into context that at the same time that, youth incarceration was increasing, we also had a general increase in incarceration writ large for adults.
Well, I want to go back to what you said about the numbers coming down. That period would coincide roughly with the time when the crime rate was going down as well. So, I guess what I'm wondering is that simply what happened there, that there was not as much crime, or were there some real reforms out there that led to fewer young people being put behind bars?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, the rate at which juveniles who had committed serious violent crimes decreased was at its peak was kind of in 1993, where we had a rate of confinement of juveniles who committed serious crimes of like 52 per 1,000 youth. That went down as of 2015 to 7.6 per 1,000 youth. So that tells you something about kind of, in terms of the commitment rates of young people. So I think the important thing to understand is there were huge amounts of reforms that definitely happened that pushed this to occur. Over the years, there's been, especially in places like Texas and New York State, there's been a huge push to close down youth prisons. Also, Massachusetts was a leader in this as well. Illinois has followed suit. That the people understood that those jails were actually schools for more criminality, that what ended up happening is young people were basically incarcerated, and what they ended up doing was learning how to become, quote, better at crime. And so they decided that it was important to actually have community-based alternatives, and that those did more to both end recidivism and also to actually curb any sort of, quote-unquote, behavior that we didn't want young people to engage in.
So when it comes to prison, you describe yourself as an abolitionist. Explain what that means to our audience.
Sure. I'm an abolitionist, and really that just means that I work towards making sure that the conditions that lead people to feeling like they need prisons and police and surveillance are transformed so that people feel a sense that those systems are unnecessary. My focus has been not just on dismantling the current systems of policing and prisons and surveillance, but also on building up, quote-unquote, alternatives to those particular institutions. So making sure that we think about how do we address harms without relying on the punishing state? How do we address harms in our communities in restorative and in transformative ways?
Now, I know that you say that you get tired of the question that comes about, of course, and I understand perhaps why, but I also know that my audience will wonder what I'm thinking if I don't ask it. What sort of world could we have where we don't have prisons or police? What are the alternatives to that if you truly are going to abolish them?
I think that's a fair question. I think that's a collective, it's going to be a collectively decided solution and an alternative. I'll say this, the prison and police and all these institutions that people take as the norm are relatively new in human history. We did not always have police or policing. We did not always have prisons and jails. You know, these institutions, particularly the prison itself, was a reform, advanced in the late 18th century as a alternative to quote-unquote capital punishment and corporal punishment. So, you know, people have always imagined ways to hold people accountable for harm. And I think the focus for me is the abolitionist project's main interest, as I mentioned, is creating the different conditions that would reshape our relations to each other. And that means, you know, if you are doing work around giving people a living wage, or if you're doing work around making sure that everybody has housing, shelter, if you are doing work around ensuring that our kids have a good education, if you're doing environmental justice work, all that is abolitionist work. Because what that means is that we would create a society where people's needs would be met, where people would necessarily have different relations to each other because their needs were met. We can't even begin to imagine how that would shift what we think we need in terms of, quote, safety and wellness. So that's how I would respond to that. And I would say the question is not what do we do with all the bad people? The question is what do we do to address the needs and the root of oppression and how that shapes what people end up doing to each other. Once that shifts and changes, I can't even imagine what that society looks like yet. And that would then definitely devolve to figuring out how we treat each other in better ways overall. And I always tell people, too, that if you understand who's actually behind bars, then you would have a less fearful response to the idea of abolition, right? The idea that all the people that are locked up are murderers and rapists. Well, you know, less than 5% of the people currently locked up are in prisons and jails because of murder and or sexual violence. So if that's your big concern, then really, then you should have a prison population and a jail population of less than 5%.
You are critical of both political parties when it comes to the issue of the prison industrial complex. But,
yes.
You know, one looking at the last election might also conclude that the candidate who spoke more loudly and vociferously about law and order was elected president, President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Given that current climate, what sort of hope do you have for making progress?
That's a really great question. I appreciate you asking it. The great thing to think about on a regular basis as it relates to criminal punishment issues is that most of the work is done and happens at the municipal and at the state level. The criminal punishment policies are mostly set at the state level and at the levels of counties. And in some very minimal cases, you know, cities in terms of ordinances. So we have lots and lots of power at the local level to make a whole bunch of different kinds of shifts that would actually bring down significantly the rates of people who are both incarcerated and criminalized. So I want people to think about, for example, the fact that your county is really who runs the jail, right? You know, often it's your sheriff that's the head of the jail. So, you know, that it's the state prison population is by, you know, many folds bigger than the federal prison population. So that is where we can make a huge difference. It's in our local places that we live. And there we have a lot more access, frankly, to the elected officials and politicians. So I'm really optimistic, or hopeful, I should say, as opposed to optimistic, hopeful about what's going to be possible as a result, despite what's happening at the federal level.
Miriam Kaba is the founder of Project NEO, which aims to end youth incarceration. She will deliver the annual MLK convocation Monday morning at 10:50 in Kalamazoo College's Stetson Chapel. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Links with more information about Monday's events and longer versions of the interviews can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.